Murkowski?
Well, Bobby was coming out of a meeting in the White House, and he saw me in the garden, and he came over and sat down on a bench just looking so sad. And he said he'd been out to see John McCone, and he said, it's just awful. They don't have any heart at CIA. They just think of everyone there as a number. He's spy X-15, and he said that he'd said to them, you know, why? This man was just feeding you too many hot things. He was just bound to get caught, and they keep asking him for more. Why didn't someone warn him? Why didn't someone tell him to get out? He has family, a wife, or children, or something. Bobby was just so wounded by them just treating that man like a cipher. Mm-hmm. Even, I guess he even thought John McCone was wrong.
Well, people get into a kind of professional sense about all this, and they no longer see people as human beings. And one of the most outrageous things was the attack on the tractor deal. I mean, here,
yeah.
If there was anything that was something which this nation should have seen as its duty, it was to do everything possible to get those people out. And the attack on it was always very baffling to me.
I know.
Remember, Mrs. Roosevelt and Walter Reuther and Milton Eisenhower formed a committee to do that.
And then everybody blasted it, and oh, I know, the heartlessness of them. Well, anyway.
I think one reason the president felt so strongly about Miro Cardona and the members of that committee is that, that three or four of them had sons.
That's right. I know Cardona had a son, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Then when the Cuban Brigade came, 1962, I guess it was,
mm-hmm.
Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
First they all came up in the afternoon to the Paul House in Florida, just the five of them or six. You know, Oliva, and they all had these, they all showed us pictures of what they looked like before they had in their wallets. They all had these wonderful sort of El Greco faces, really thin. When they pulled pictures out of what they looked like before, they really looked sort of like fat members of Xavier Cugat's band. I mean, they didn't have any pathos in their face. And how they were with us, you know, there they were sitting with Jack, nothing bitter, just looking on him as their hero. You know, they were nice men too. Then they came since November. They must have, when I was in this house, which I moved into, they came in February, especially up to Jack's grave to lay a wreath. And Bobby brought them, one of them, around to see me. And they all said that they were getting out of the army or everything, that now that Jack was dead, they had no more hope or idealism or anything. They'd just all go out and try to get some jobs, because it was he they were all looking to with hope. They're the man that had got them into it.
Mm-hmm.
Rather touching.
The president was deeply moved, wasn't he, at that Miami business?
Oh, yes. That was one of the most moving things I've ever seen. All those people there, you know, crying and waving, and all the poor brigades sitting around with their bandages and everything.
I think he was carried away and said some things that were in the text of his speech.
I remember speaking, you and I had to speak in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a wonderful man that you should speak to sometimes is Donald Barnes. Of all the interpreters Jack ever had, he was always the one for Spanish. And he was so head and shoulders above any other. And he made you have a good relationship with the person.
Mm-hmm.
That man was in so many. I don't know, someone should interview him.
Is he what was State Department?
State Department interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them weren't very good. The one we had in Paris was just hopeless. Poor Sedgwick trying to say his sort of flowery 18th century French, which no more sounded like a translation of Jack. Barnes was, Jack said the two best interpreters he'd ever seen were Barnes and Adenauer's interpreter, who we used in Germany instead of our own.
Mm-hmm.
He asked Adenauer if he could borrow his.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever talk about the future of Castro and Cuba? Do you think that, what did he think, do you think?
Gosh. I don't know what he thought. I remember asking him this fall. Yes, that day that I told you about was one day in October when he woke up from his nap and he looked very worried. I woke him up. I said something and he said, this has been one of the worst days of my life. 10 things have gone wrong and it's only 2:30. And he named some of them, which I should have written down. Anyway, one I can remember was that some little raid on Cuba had failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of said, well, what is the point of all these little raids? You know. But he didn't, I didn't like, he sort of taught, you know, he didn't really answer that question. He obviously didn't want to sit down with me and to talk about Cuba because it was a worry to him. So I don't know what he had in his head, what his thoughts were.
Jean, did you see the interview that Jean Daniel
had? Yes.
Did that sound, what did you make of that?
Well, I thought it no more sounded like Jack, and I can remember being in Mrs. Lincoln's office when Jean Daniel was brought in and being introduced to him first.
Mm-hmm.
Then that came out after Jack was dead, didn't it?
That's right.
Well, it didn't sound like Jack.
Mm-hmm.
I forget it, but a lot of... And then I even saw someone wrote it was over. I can't remember what it said now, but it didn't sound
the language did not sound like him. Some of the things that were said did sound like him, and some didn't.
I don't even know if Danielle spoke English.
I think Ben Bradley brought him in, as I recall.
Now, when I saw him, he was alone, but maybe Ben sent him.
Ben sent him, I guess. When you know, eventually Miro Cardona got mad at the United States government and issued a blast and so on.
Yes, I can remember later on Cardona became rather a nuisance.
Mm-hmm. I always felt the president understood and had a certain sympathy with the frustrations.
Yes. You know, and he never said anything awful about him.
Mm-hmm.
Just... You know, that was one more worrying thing in a day when there'd be a blast from Miro Cardona.
The president had been interested in Latin America, particularly because it became such a major interest in the administration. Of course, he'd gone to Argentina, hadn't he, in 1939 or something like that.
Yes, he'd been there. I think he'd been to Brazil and a lot of places. Had he been? But he was really quite young then.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, you know, I never remember him talking specially about Latin America before. It was really, when he got into the White House, well, we were there a very short time when he made his alliance speech, mm-hmm. So he obviously must have been thinking about it. During the campaign and the interregnum, you know. And, did I tell you about in the trip to Mexico? The trip to Venezuela. There was, I went to an orphanage and there was a picture in the paper that evening. All the children were kissing me goodbye. And the headline was, you know, it was very complimentary. It said, "We love Mrs. Kennedy. Look, she permits herself to be kissed by gringo children or by, you know, Indian children," mm-hmm. whatever they were. And that just hurt Jack so for them. And he said, you know, look at those people. You just don't know the inferiority complex they have that the United States has given them. And isn't it sad that they should be writing something like that?
Mm-hmm.
You could see in the visit to Mexico as it went along how Lopez Mateos really began to see that Jack believed all those things he was saying about our revolution was like yours. And, you know, at last they had someone they could trust who felt about them.
That must have been an exciting visit, the Mexican visit.
That, to me, that was the most exciting of all.
More than even Berlin?
Well, I didn't go to Berlin, well, you see.
Go to Berlin, yeah.
Because I was having John, Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Berlin was, to him, the most unbelievable. But, so what did I have? Paris and Vienna. and Colombia and Venezuela. Well, Vienna was incredible in that it was miles in from the airport and back, and it was a dark gray day, and just to see those crowds going on for 25 miles, mostly weeping and waving handkerchiefs, that was one of the most impressive crowds I've seen. But, my gosh, the movie of Mexico I saw it the other day.
It's fantastic. It's
like, you know, it looked like a pink snowstorm, mm-hmm. That paper coming down and the cheers and the vivas. And they keep thinking of new things to yell vivas about. Viva Kennedy, viva Los Kennedys Católicos, viva everything.
He had an extraordinary sympathy for Latin America, for the problems of Latin America, which they got, and it.
And he liked the Latins too. And I remember I was so surprised because I thought, and I said this to him, and he agreed. Of all the great men that I met while we were in the White House or before, you think there's De Gaulle, Macmillan, Nehru, Khrushchev. The one that impressed me the most was Yeris Camargo of Colombia. You know, he wasn't at all, and Betancourt enormously. Mm-hmm. But Yeris Camargo more, he was this thoughtful, he almost seemed not German, but Nordic in his sadness.
Mm-hmm.
And just his dedication, that man getting thinner and thinner. When he came here to the hospital, and I went to see him. You know, nothing was ever in the papers about it. And he came in so thin to Jack's office. I guess he'd really, Jack said he's real. I said, he looks so awful since we saw him in Colombia. And he said, yes, he's done all that, you know, working for the Alliance. And he said he'd help again. But those two men, and then I said to Jack, I'd always have this mania before about making my children learn French, because I saw how that other language absolutely doubled my life. And made you be able to meet all those people that you... But I said, you know, I'm going to make my children learn Spanish as their second language. You know, we should just, if De Gaulle and everyone want to have their own little thing. But really, we should turn to this hemisphere. And I'm going to do that anyway.
I think one of the greatest things he did was to restore a sense of this being a common hemisphere, which had gone out of the United States entirely since Roosevelt and the Good Neighbor Policy.
And it's so shocking, he noticed it in Mexico, and I noticed it again, I remembered it before. When you say, we say America there, meaning our country, mm-hmm. but America to them means both continents. Mm-hmm. They say North America and South America. And you know, you have to bite your lip a couple of times when you're talking about America.
Mm-hmm.
And,
The Kennedy name means more. It's the best asset we have in Latin America at the moment. I wish, you know, I wish the new administration, for example, asked Bobby to go down
Venezuela asked especially for Bobby, and Lyndon Johnson wouldn't send him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just absolutely, Mark Betancourt, the first president of Venezuela who served out his term, would have been great.
Yeah, I suppose.
I hope you'll go there sometime.
Yeah, I'll go, but that, you know, that won't have anything to do with policy.
No, it will remind them what North America is capable of, which will mean a lot. Same time that all the Cuban thing was going, there was this problem of Laos. Do you remember anything about that? You know, there was some talk of American intervention there, which...
Oh, yeah. Well, it just seems always there was Laos, Cuba, South... You know, I remember Laos so well, in Berlin, but I can't remember which month was which.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't he go on the television and speak about Laos?
Yeah, that was... next year, I think, but you're right, The crisis was sort of simmering. No, you're right, it was that spring that he did.
And then twice he went on about Berlin, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. spoke about Berlin in June.
So I don't remember. There was always something like that about to blow up, and always Jack living with that and the pressure of being in the White House and yet trying to live in an ordinary way and be what you should be for him when he came home. Hear what he had to say but not ask too many questions about something painful. I remember once this year about South Vietnam. Well, usually I was so good about not asking questions, but then with all those flames and Diem and everything, the only time I really did, I asked him something, and he said, and it was at the end of the day, and he said, "Oh my God, kid," which was, it sounds funny, but I got used to it. It was a sort of a term of endearment that I suppose his family used. He said, "I've had that, on me all day," and I just, he'd just been swimming at the pool and sort of changed into his happy evening mood.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Don't remind me of that all over again." And I just felt so criminal that he could make this conscious effort to turn from worry to relative insouciance.
It was a great source of strength, I think, to be able to do that.
So I wasn't asking him about, and then he said to me either that time or another, "Don't ask me about those things." He said, "You can ask Bundy to let you see all the cables." Or go ask Brad. And I said, "I don't want to see all the cables." I used to get all the India-Pakistan cables because I loved to read Ken Galbraith's cables. Then when Ken left, I said, "Will you please?" And I used to get the weekly CIA, summary. Finally, I just couldn't bear to read through those anymore. They put me into such a state of depression. There was never one good thing in them. Jack had to read those all the time. But he'd say, "Well, go ask Bundy everything you want to know about that. He'll tell you." So I decided it was better to live. You get enough by osmosis and reading the papers and, not ask. And live in... I always thought there was one thing merciful about the White House, which made up for the goldfish bowl and the Secret Service and all that, was that it was kind of, you were hermetically sealed, or there was something protective against the outside world. You didn't realize, you didn't hear mean things people were saying about you until a lot later, and you could sort of live in your strange little life in there. He couldn't, but as far as your private life went. And I decided that was the best thing to do. Everyone should be trying to help Jack in whatever way they could. And that was the way I could do it the best. By being not a distraction. Mm-hmm. That's not... by bringing him... by making it always a climate of affection and comfort and détente when he came home.
Mm-hmm.
And the people around that he... I would try to have people who divert him.
Mm-hmm.
There were always people from Washington, but who wouldn't be right on the subject that he thrashed about all day.
No.
And good food and the children in good moods, and if you ever knew of someone who was in town or could get someone interesting, I try to do that.
Did you do all the inviting?
Yes.
He had absolute confidence.
Yeah, and a lot of times I'd, if I couldn't think of someone or something, I'd call up Mrs. Lincoln and say, "If the president wants anyone, tell him to ask whoever he wants for this evening." Because some evenings, I wouldn't want to sat. A couple of times you'd arrange a little dinner of six people, and it might be a night where he wanted to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
So I must say our last year was just one or two people all the time, and then he'd decide when, with Mrs. Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Or else I'd... Walton, anyone.
You remember when President Nkrumah came?
Oh, yes. He was, I think he was the very first visitor we had. He came up and sat with us in the West Hall, you know, in our private private
apartment.
Sitting apartments. And Stash was there. And Lee. And Stash had just told us before that Nkrumah had bought the biggest yacht in the Mediterranean that belonged to some shifty Greek friend of Stash's, the Radiant Mavrolian. So Stash asked him about it. I mean, and his eyes sort of rolled, and he said, yes, it was being used to train the Ghanaian Navy. And Jack had a good laugh about that later with Stash. But he was very, he was nice, and he was gay, he had this laugh. You didn't realize what a bandit he was going to turn out to be.
Yes, he's behaved in the most terrible way recently, but that was quite a...
But he was
agreeable visit, wasn't it?
Terribly agreeable, and he was so, you could see he was so delighted to be, you know, in the family apartments, and I think he saw the children. He was so happy. And then I guess he'd given me some present, so I wrote him a thank you letter in my own handwriting and said, trying to be polite, because Jack made you feel how important it was that you make the Africans, how awfully everybody'd always treated the Africans,
mm-hmm.
how Eisenhower had kept Haile Selassie waiting something like 45 minutes, and, you know, and this chip on their shoulder they had anyway. So I wrote them in my own hand, and to be nice, I said, would you send me a picture of yourself, because you were our first visitor, foreign visitor. So about 2 weeks later, Ghana ambassador in all his robes came wading in and gave me the picture. But you know, in the beginning I liked Nkrumah.
Mm-hmm.
The only person I met who you knew was a bandit before he came and turned out to be all you expected was Sukarno.
Sukarno was as bad as...
Again, we had him. Those were sort of working visits, mm-hmm. whatever you call them. But Jack brought him up to the West sitting room. Just before lunch, I think he sort of had all these little ways of doing something a little bit extra for people. So one thing was to come up and either have a drink before lunch or tea, whatever it was, with me up there. He saw that coming into the house would mean something to them. And so I'd gotten these State Department briefing papers on Sukarno, and it said that Mao Tse-tung had published his art collection, which meant an enormous amount to him. He was so flattered. So that morning I called the State Department, and someone said, could I please get those volumes over? Because I thought it would impress Sukarno so if he saw them on our table. Mm-hmm. Well, they got there about 20 minutes before he did, and I hardly had time to flip through them. So I said, you know, Mr. whatever you call him, president or prime minister, I forget, but I knew. We have your art collection here, and we started to look at the volume together. It was enormous. Sukarno was in the middle, all three of us in the sofa, and Jack and I on each side, and he thumbed through the pages. It was just a collection of, like, Varga girls.
Oh, really?
You know, every single petty girls, every single one with naked to the waist with a hibiscus in her hair. And you just couldn't believe it. And I caught Jack's eye, and we were trying not to laugh at each other. I mean, you know, trying not, I was so off, but Sukarno was terribly happy, and he'd say, this is my second wife, and this was... But he was sort of, I don't know, he had sort of a lecherous look. And he left a bad taste in your mouth.
Anyone else you didn't like among the...
I didn't like Ajoube. And I didn't like him. He came up the Cape. Well, all right, it was very good what Jack did with him, and Pierre arranged that in the interview and everything, but he came up there for that interview. And he's a big, brash guy. Maybe he's very sensitive underneath. But... he came in the room, and John came in the living room at the Cape, came running out of the dining room or something, having escaped from his show as usual. And as you raise it, ah, here is your son. In a few years, he and my son will be shooting each other in a war or something.
Very funny.
You know, the most. With a big laugh. Yeah. I mean, he had that same heavy-handed humor Khrushchev had, but I thought much worse. Yet I liked enormously his wife. I didn't really like Madame Khrushchev too much, and I hated the daughter that Khrushchev had in Vienna. She looked like some Wehrmacht blonde who ran a concentration camp. But Azhukbe's wife was the only Russian woman. Mrs. Khrushchev and Mrs. Dobrynin. Dobrynin asked Jack specially if I'd have his wife to lunch alone, and I did. But both of them have this really gamesmanship thing. If you smoke, they say you shouldn't smoke so much. Russian women don't smoke. Did you go to engineering school? You know, always trying to make themselves seem better. I suppose it was a chip on their shoulder, but I'm trying to be polite, and it didn't make it very comfortable. And Azhukbe's wife, Khrushchev's daughter, was the only one who was sort of funny, who'd say, oh, don't you get tired of your children at the end of the day, or if only I could get a decent cook. Or, you know, she'd make little jokes, but she was very shy, but she seemed sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered how she ended up with such a brash man, but maybe he's nicer underneath. Because if you notice in Bill Walton's report that he wrote about Russia when he went there after Jack was dead, Azhukbe was really impressed that a doll Khrushchev had given Caroline was in her bedroom. It was one of the things she loved to take apart.
Mm-hmm.
And a little table by her bed, also with the Virgin Mary and things.
Hmm.
You know, so obviously they're sensitive as they can be underneath.
Madame Khrushchev.
Well, de Gaulle said to me in Paris, we were there before Vienna, "Méfiez-vous, c'est elle la plus maligne." Watch out, it's she who is the craftiest of the two. Though she has, I loved her when she was in America with the Eisenhower visit. Then I just knew her through the newspapers. Mm-hmm. I thought she had such a nice face.
Especially my best Truman's, a nice, comfortable.
Yeah.
Room.
She was a bit maligne, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she really, I mean, I got sick of all that. Those little digs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very shy at the palace in Vienna where we had lunch. There was this protocol thing. For some reason, I outranked her because Jack was president and Khrushchev was just chairman of the whatever it is. So she wouldn't leave the room before I did. And I didn't like to go before an older woman. And, you know, she was just so hanging back. And nobody could seem to help. So finally I said, in desperation, I took her by the hand and said, well, I'm very shy, so you have to come with me. And Tish and some interpreter told me that she darted over to a Russian in her party in the wall and said, did you hear what she said to me? You know, and she was sort of beaming.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they're all shy underneath. I mean, have their little chips.
Mm-hmm.
But Khrushchev, with his heavy humor, was... he'd say nice, but he was...
Does he have any charm, Khrushchev?
Yeah, it's just one gag after another. It's like sitting next to Abbott and Costello or something to get through that dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But this is...
sort of a professional jolliness? And...
Yes, but it's better than... I don't know, sitting next to Kekkonen of Finland and asking him how long he walks every morning before breakfast. But then, you know, they have this ballet. And I said all these swooping ballerinas in Schönbrunn would come swooping towards Jack and Khrushchev and me and Madame Khrushchev. And I said, they're all dancing. They're all paying most attention to you, Mr. Chairman, President. They're all throwing their... And he said, no, it is your husband they are paying attention to. You must never let him go on a state visit alone. He is such a... wonderful looking young man or something. You know, he'd say something sort of nice every now and then. And then like a fool, I told Jack this later, he couldn't believe it. I was running out of things to talk to that man about. And And Jack always said, you mustn't talk to these great men. I mean, Mrs. Kennedy would read up about Russia or the wheat crop or something. That's the last thing they want to hear about. Talk to them about something different. Well, I just read The Sabres of Paradise by Leslie Blanche, which is all about the Ukraine in the 19th century and the wars and things, and the dance. It sounded to me so rather romantic, the Ukraine. So I was telling him how I loved all that, and the dance, the Lezginka, and the Kabarda stallion. And he said something about, oh yes, the Ukraine has a, now we have more teachers there per something or more wheat. And I said, oh, Mr. Chairman President, don't bore me with that. I think the romantic side is so much. And then he laughed. And then all I can remember, as, you know, last he could let down too. So God knows what, we were probably talking about the Tsar, I don't know. Oh, and then I knew that one of those dogs that had puppies, one of those space dogs, I knew all the names of those dogs, Strelkin, Belkin, like. So I said, I see one of your space dogs has just had puppies. Why don't you send me one? And he just sort of laughed. And by God, we were back in Washington about 2 months later. And two absolutely sweating, ashen-faced Russians come staggering into the Oval Room with the ambassador carrying this poor, terrified puppy who'd obviously never been out of a laboratory with needles in every vein. And Jack said to me, I had forgotten to tell him that. He said, how did this dog get here? And I said, well, I'm afraid I asked Khrushchev for it. Vienna, I was just running out of things to say. And he said, you played right into his hands, reminding the space effort. But he laughed.
How did he like Khrushchev?
Oh, well, that time in Vienna, there was no, remember what he said at the end of that? Their conversations, he showed me all the transcript, it's going to be a cold winter. And he said that in, you know, really scared. Then I think you'd seen just naked, brutal, ruthless power. And, you know, then Khrushchev thought he could do what he wanted with Jack. The truth, Khrushchev could be jolly, but underneath there's,
he was very tough there. The president came back very concerned, I remember.
Oh, he really was. I think he was quite really depressed after that visit. Mm-hmm.
Had he gone there with any particular expectations about Khrushchev, or this was really sort of testing out, wasn't it?
I don't think he'd gone there. You know, I think he'd gone there expecting to be depressed, but I think it was so much worse than he thought.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he hadn't gone there with any lovely illusions. They could all work together. But then I used to tell him, for some strange reason, I liked Gromyko's face. But this was before the second Cuba. Because one day, it was the funniest thing. I came out for a walk, and there were he and Gromyko sitting in the Rose Garden. Before we'd done it over, there was a tiny little bench that, you know, two lovers could barely squish onto. And he and Gromyko were sitting there in that little love seat talking, and Jack told me later he wanted to get him out of the office and talk alone. And I walked by, so Jack called me over. And I said to them, the two of you look so absurd just sitting in each other's laps like that. And then Gromyko smiled. People say he looked like Nixon, but he had a nice smile when he smiled.
Oh, really? He always looked awfully wooden to me.
Well, if he did smile, it was something, I don't know. But then, you know, all the things he said to Jack before the second Cuba, mm-hmm. That was really clever of Jack, the way he did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other time they met in the Oval Room, and Jack said to him, we don't trade an apple for an orchard in this country.
Mm-hmm.
See, I can't remember what year. Why they were seeing each other then. But I know, I think Gromyko must have come three times.
Mm-hmm. Third one was in 63.
Maybe four.
But on the whole, were state visits fun, or were they a nuisance?
Well, they were,
Or would it vary, I suppose?
They weren't a nuisance. I'd say they were really quite a strain. You know, the week that there was one, you'd really be tired. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to think. And in the early days, later on they got much better, but in the early days you'd have to do so many things. I mean, just like you would for a dinner in your house now if you didn't have any help. You had to see about the table and the flowers. I mean, sometimes Bunny Mellon and I would be there just before it was time to get dressed for dinner doing the flowers, you know, before you got in the people who could do them. And the food, and then we had to work out a way that wouldn't come always cold from the kitchen. You know, there's no pantry in the White House. The kitchen is below, and there used to be these endless waits. And then the entertainment you'd have to work on and get a stage. But there was a lot of strain anticipating them, and I'd say the only one that really was hard going was the Japanese Ikeda, who was, a very nice man, but neither he nor hardly anyone in his party spoke a word of English.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit heavy going for lots of meetings. But I liked them. I liked Aboud of the Sudan. I did like Karamanlis, Madame Karamanlis especially. So many. Each one was, and what it meant to them. You know, that was what was so touching.
Macmillan came in April. Do you remember? You'd known him before, had you, or the president had?
Jack had met him, right after, in Key West, and then in, he met him in London after Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
It was just before Vienna that he came?
He came in April, before Vienna.
Well, I forget if that was the time.
You must have known him before through the Devonshire, so.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
But I know they'd corresponded ever since Jack was first in the White House. But, yes, then we had lunch, just Sissy and David and Macmillan and Jack and I,
mm-hmm.
which was so nice. And they, they stayed. But it was such a happy atmosphere, and they would stay in and talk. That was a very rare and touching relationship between those two men. They really loved each other. And, if you could see their letters. And I'll show them to you someday, because I can't do them all on the tape. The one he wrote Jack by hand this summer after Patrick, when he just was through the perfumo thing, and how Jack went out of his way to send him some telegram when he resigned and tell David that it could be in all the papers of all that he'd done for the West. He loved Macmillan. You know, Macmillan had a way of looking like sort of a joke. Just his face had that sort of suppressed mirth and his funny clothes and things. But,
He was a sharp old customer.
Yeah.
And I had the impression the president was particularly impressed by his strong feeling about nuclear, about getting the nuclear thing under control.
Yeah. I know.
Macmillan used to write eloquent letters about the horror of nuclear war. And I think
yes, and what did Jack say? And that was one of the things he said. And what had Macmillan done for the, at least that Jack said, and he really cared about the Western Alliance,
mm-hmm.
nuclear, everything.
What did the president like Gateskill?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he?
Yes, he did. Do you remember his reaction to Harold Wilson?
Oh, he couldn't stand him. Want me to show you?
There was a special relationship. And why, the President Macmillan, what would they talk about beside politics? Because obviously they had a great fund of other things. Macmillan was a publisher and loved history.
Well, they would be so irreverent and funny. Jack would tell me some of the things they said with the men at dinner, after lunch that I don't think I should say on a tape even. What is it? One thing was, people say that the younger generation have lost all hope living with this nuclear something. Look at them, they're perfectly fine, they're twisting and... But I don't know, just funny things. They'd amuse each other so. So then when the one time I was ever together with them was that time at lunch in the White House. And when they came out, somebody said something about Nehru, and I said how Nehru had given Lee a miniature of two Indians on a couch together and given me one of just a lady sniffing a rose, and how he had his hand on Lee's thigh at the airport, or something rather irreverent. He just looked shocked, but you know, it was so funny. That doesn't describe what I mean. Jack had this high sense of mischief, and so did Macmillan, so I've never seen two people enjoy each other so. Obviously, all the important things they were talking about alone, but when it ended up with Sissy and David and us and him, you know, or going down to Adele Astaire Douglas's, who'd been married to a Cavendish, or, you know, talk about a lot of family things, I guess. But always this wonderful humor underneath it all.
President's year, when he went to London in 38-39, he wasn't there very much, but it obviously it struck a responsive chord, didn't it?
I always thought it was really British history that he patterned himself on more than ours. I mean, that he read, he was always, I tell you all the speeches, Burke's to the electors of
Bristol
and Warren Hastings and, you know, Charles James Fox, and then that showed him what to pick out, and he really gave himself a classical education through his own reading. I don't think you get that in this country anymore. Mostly through being sick and having read, but you know, the classics and then the English people, and then that made him pick out what he thought was best in American thought and oratory. So he had such an admiration for all system, and but when you look at when we go, the last time we were in London together, I guess was 58 maybe, and had a dinner of all his old friends. Well, when you look at them all, it was rather discouraging. David Gore was the only one who ever amounted to anything, and he was, Jack always used to say, he was one of the brightest men he'd ever met in his life. He and Bundy used to say. But, you know, the others were all kind of defeatist or turned into nothing. Or, you know, he wasn't like Joe Alsop, who dearly loves the Lord and just gets so excited at the mention of anyone English. To see England now really depressed Jack of all those young men who'd been his friends as in 38 and 39, Hugh Fraser, Tony Roslin.
Well, Hugh's in the government, but it's a disappointed life.
Yeah.
Did he ever know Churchill?
William Hume, that was a great friend of his.
Oh, the Alec's brother.
Yes, he'd like kick, and he'd written, you know, he'd gone to prison.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't fire on civilians in a town. And that's where he wrote Now Barabbas. Then he wrote the Chilton Hundreds about Kathleen. Kathleen, she was the model for the American Girl. She used to go see him in prison. And well, William was wicked and outrageous and fun. Jack always enjoyed him. But his plays got worse and worse and worse.
You play the reluctant
Prime Minister. Prime Minister. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, poor William, he has about four children to support. And he has to write too quickly.
Did he know Alec and that Hume in that period?
I don't think so.
He's quite different from William, I guess.
Yeah, well, William's sort of mad. He said, Jack said something at the Black Watch, you know, this little speech before, about all of us have been drawn, I suppose, are drawn to lost causes. In Scotland's history, captured him at an early age. It really was a long series of lost causes, but it triumphed in some ways more than ever now. And as we were walking off the lawn up to the balcony where we'd watch the whole show, Jack said, I wonder if David Gore knew what I meant. Well, he'd meant that Alec Douglas Hume, a Scotchman, was now Prime Minister. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did he like Alec Douglas Hume?
Well, had he met him?
Yes.
Had Alec Hume come over?
Yes, he'd not as Prime Minister, but he'd been over as Foreign Secretary. They met.
I think he did like him. I mean, I know he didn't dislike him. But the first time I ever saw Alec Hume was at Jack's funeral. Mm-hmm. And I liked him.
He's a nice man. Had he ever known Churchill?
The time we met Churchill was in Monte Carlo. And some people, we'd been asked, we were staying in, we had a house in Cannes with William Douglas Hume and his wife. And
this was when?
Was it either 1958, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the Agnellis had, we were going over to have dinner with them, and then they took us before dinner to Onassis's yacht to meet Churchill. Jack had always wanted to meet Churchill. Well, the poor man was really quite gaga then. And a lot about through, you know, we all came on the boat together, and he didn't quite know which one Jack was. He started to talk to one of the other men there, thinking he was Jack, and saying, I knew your father so well, and this and that. And that was cleared up. Then Jack sat down with him and talked, but it was hard going. Mm-hmm. I don't think he'd met him before. But of course, you know, he read everything.
He really had read practically everything of Churchill.
I felt so sorry for Jack that evening because he was meeting his hero.
Mm-hmm.
Only he met him, you know, too late. Oh, think of all he could have. He was so hungry to talk to Churchill at last or meet him. Mm-hmm. And he just met Churchill, and Churchill couldn't really say anything.
Mm-hmm. Adenauer also came over that first spring.
Yes. Jack used to say, sort of what a bitter old man Adenauer was, or how he had to be pried. He used to say, 89, wouldn't you think he'd give up then? But they had to haul him off screaming. You know, he got awfully fed up with them. Adenauer and all that Berlin. He'd take one private home because his mother's had an appendix or something, and they'd start another weeping round. And he hated that ambassador here.
Mm-hmm.
Only two ambassadors he'd really disliked were that one, Greve, and the Pakistan ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmed, well, the new one's named Ahmed, so this was the Ahmed before this one.
Well, the Germans wanted reassurance all the time. And it got to be a pain in the neck.
And you know, how much more that can you do than reassure them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he really did it, obviously, when he went to Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember much about the trip to Canada?
Oh, yes, spring? That was our first...
It was your first trip.
I remember everything about it. You know, getting off. And Vanier, the Governor General, is the most marvelous-looking old man. And Madame, you know, white moustache, sort of like C. Aubrey Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Madame Vanier, very motherly, everyone curtsies to them. And I rode in from the airport with her. That must be about 50 miles from the airport to Ottawa. And she would be telling me how to wave and always calling me dear. She was very protective. I was still very tired then. And so I had to leave the receiving line that night. You know, half sort of way through, and Jack was so sweet, rather protective, getting me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I just had so little strength then. So before we went to Europe, I took a whole week off from the country to get so that I'd sleep and build up my strength, and it was all right. But everyone was saying that that Ottawa was so cold and never gave receptions to nice ones to anyone, and I guess especially to America or something, and they really were. Well, they seemed like terribly enthusiastic crowds, and everyone was flabbergasted. You know, you could tell they meant it. Here you often say to state visitors, you're riding in from the airport, Washington is blasé, and I've never seen them go so mad for any visitor as they do for you. Because they are hopeless here.
Mm-hmm.
But you stand. But he didn't like Diefenbaker.
But Diefenbaker already was sort of erratic and crazy, was he?
Oh, yes, and you know, Mrs. Diefenbaker's such a nice woman. But we had lunch at Diefenbaker's house, and he insisted on telling all these Churchill stories in accent and calling him Old Winston or the Old Boy or something. You know, it was just painful. He didn't like Diefenbaker, and then you know the story of that. There was a paper that was left behind.
The Rostow Memorandum.
Yeah. Well, Diefenbaker really tried to blackmail Jack with that.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever Jack said back to him was rather clever. Something of, to how did you get this paper?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he never liked that man.
Mm-hmm.
And he always liked Lester Pearson.
You had met de Gaulle before when he came over here.
I just met de Gaulle. Jack was campaigning in the Oregon, out in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I just met him at a reception at the French Embassy, and I guess I talked to him for about 10 minutes.
Was he easy to talk to?
I suppose he wasn't. I told him how much Jack admired him and made up some completely... But I thought he was easy to talk to when we were in France.
Mm-hmm. That was a nice visit, wasn't it, to Paris?
Because I'd ask him things of history, or all the things I wanted to know, like who did Louis XVI's daughter marry, the Duke of Angoulême, did she have any children, and this or that. And well, he was rather, then he leaned across the table to Jack at lunch and said, but Mrs. Kennedy knows more French history than most French women. So Jack said, my God, that would be like me sitting next to Madame de Gaulle and her asking me all about Henry Clay. So, you know, he was very pleased. But then you could ask de Gaulle so many things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not talking about the obvious. De Gaulle has a sort of courtly, rather nice way with women. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know he was interested in me and everything and impressed by Jack. And it was also, Bundy was sitting right across from us at this first lunch, and you know, Bundy really looks very young. And de Gaulle said to me rather imperiously, et qui est ce jeune homme? Because he was also staring at Kenny O'Donnell. I don't know if Dave Powers was at the lunch too. And I, head of the National Security Council, I don't know if he knew what that meant. And they said, and he was the most brilliant young head of Harvard. So he leaned across and said something about Harvard in very halting French, you know, slow French that you would say to someone who might not speak it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bundy answered in this brilliant French. I was just so proud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was strike one for our side.
Yeah.
Or, a first run for our side.
What was Madame de Gaulle like?
She just looks so long-suffering, poor woman, so tired. You know, they have more state visits than anyone. So sweetly going through. They're very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But just limping through it all. At Versailles, the table was fantastic. You know, he'd had all the gold. It was Napoleon's inkwell, or something was in front of us, and the tablecloth had a lot of gold embroidery on it. So Jack turned to Madame de Gaulle and said, it's one attempt at talking to her, because she just sits there staring ahead, she's so tired. It's said, "This is the most beautiful tablecloth," and her answer was, "The one at lunch was better." And he said, "Oh," and they fell into silence again. You know, in all the foreign state visits, it's different than here. The two men sit next to each other. I always ask Jack if he'd like to do that at the White House.
Oh, really? In other words, the head of state sits next to the other head of state. Right?
Yeah, so it would go from right to left, Madame de Gaulle, Jack, de Gaulle, and me.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you'd go to their dinners here, it would be done that way most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Jack said no, he didn't want to do it that way. He said he saw enough of them all day in his conferences.
He and de Gaulle got along well then, didn't they? I mean, it was...
Oh, I think de Gaulle was very impressed by Jack.
Mm-hmm. There weren't any premonitions then of the mischief that de Gaulle was to make later.
Well, I think I know Jack always knew that, because he said it, before the trip. And he'd read everything that Roosevelt said. He knew de Gaulle had this thing about the West, so I guess there wasn't anything then problem, but I think Jack knew it would come. Oh, he asked de Gaulle about his relations with Churchill and Roosevelt, and de Gaulle said, with Churchill I was always in disagreement, but we always reached an accord. With Roosevelt, I was never in disagreement, and we never reached an accord. That's the gist of it. He said it so much better, and again, I didn't write that down.
Had you known Malraux before the...
No, I don't. Nicole Alphon asked me, what would I like to do in the French visit? And you could see that anything you said, they turned the place upside down. So I said, please, Nicole, I don't want anything. Whatever you plan is wonderful. The only thing I'd like to do is somehow could I meet André Malraux. Do you think I could even sit next to him at some thing? And you see how really protocol and ruthless the French are, because, of course, about 4 days before we got there, both his sons were killed in an automobile crash.
Okay.
And at the first reception, that first night at the Elysee, suddenly the doors open and these two black crows come in. Their faces just all white and puffy from crying through and all Melrose ticks going at once. And the whole place just fell into a hush. But obviously it was the one thing I'd asked, and so... Well, in a way, so the next day Malraux took me to the Jeu de Paume and then out to Malmaison. And then he was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gave him, in a way, it made him, I don't know, I suppose it's good to have something to do after something like that. But that's when my friendship started. And just listening to him.
He and the president connect?
Not so much then. They didn't have that much time to see each other, but when Malraux came over here, they really did, and then they came out to the country, you know, for a little, mm-hmm. for lunch, and then Malraux came back for the Mona Lisa,
mm-hmm.
and again, we had another evening of just us and then the Alphonse. Yeah. But you know, it's funny, walking down, I guess as we were walking from the dinner at Versailles to the theater, I was first with de Gaulle, and Jack was behind with Madame de Gaulle and Malraux, and there were all these statues down the long hall. And Jack said to Malraux, "Who's that?" And Malraux said to the interpreter, "Tell the president he has picked the only one that isn't a fake." Which was true, and I thought, again, that's what I said about Jack's eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really impressed Malraux.
Yeah. Had the president ever read Malraux, any of the novels, or?
I think he'd read Man's Hope. But, you know, he knew.
Could you attract him? Can you understand his French easily?
Mm. Well, he talks so fast, but I can.
Mm-hmm.
Or else he... No, but it's like being taken over this incredible obstacle course at 90 miles an hour. You know, what he makes your mind jump to, back forth. He is the most fascinating man I've ever talked to, but again, he's rather disillusioning because he sort of admires the simplest things. I mean, that dinner at the White House, his most impressive moment was when they took the color, the color flags, the honor guard downstairs. And then who was it? Oh, Irwin Shaw told me his greatest moment in life was when he was head of a brigade or something in the Maquis.
Mm-hmm.
And he worships de Gaulle like, some cocker spaniel adores its master. I mean, he seems to have this incredible intellect and then certain sort of blind spots.
Mm-hmm.
And very old-fashioned France and La Gloire and flags. But anyway.
How are he and de Gaulle together? Did you see them?
No, I didn't see them together very much. But, he was de Gaulle's lieutenant all through those years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, de Gaulle. De Gaulle was rather grand with him. Especially as I wanted to talk to him. He was always sort of leading you away.
Mm-hmm.
In public. He's very... he treats him like some servant, like Nehru treats the man who sleeps outside his doors. I mean...
Jim Gavin was our ambassador.
Yes.
And it was always a rather puzzling appointment. I know the president wanted to do something for Jim. Certainly, he's a fine man. Do you know why he was? Have you ever? President ever said?